It's time again for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. Good evening. John Suntress here. Phil Hester joins us to say he's not chasing Batgirl anymore. The artist has been a busy writer these days, creating The Anchor for Boom Studios, writing The Darkness for Top Cow, and Black Terror for Dynamite. We get the lowdown on all these series, plus Phil talks about some deals brewing for The Coffin and Firebreather. And we talk about the changing comics market and why some creators may be holding on to their best ideas for their own exploitation. The conversation starts with Phil's role as a breakdown artist on Dynamite's Green Hornet series, adapted from an unfilmed screenplay by Kevin Smith. Can we start with the Hornet?
Sure.
I was pleased to see in the credits that you were there for breakdowns, and I think I know what that means. It's kind of comparable to what Keith Giffen was doing on 52, but for a very different reason. Why don't you explain?
Yeah, sort of like what Keith was doing. When I describe it to the older fans, I describe it as what Harvey Kurtzman was doing on some of the war books for EC, or what he was doing on Flash Gordon with Dan Barry.
That's so funny. I just picked up that collection, so go right ahead.
It's a beautiful... I look at that thing once a month, probably. But what I do is I take Kevin's script, and because Kevin's scripts are very dense, and Jonathan Lau, who, while a fantastic artist, is a little inexperienced, at least with American comics, and I'm experienced with Kevin's scripts, they give me Kevin's scripts, and then I break them down into little dummies of a real comic book, thumbnails. And so I lay out each page with very rudimentary figures. And the most important thing I do is I spot the word balloons, which Kevin's word balloons can be big and dense, and it's up to me to chop them into readable size and then place them on the panel so that they lead the reader along the page in a natural progression.
Are you working from a film screenplay? And if you are, how different is that from the scripts that you used to get from Kevin as a comic writer on Green Arrow and the Oni books and everything else?
I'm working from a modified screenplay, yeah. And it's not that different from the way Kevin writes his comics. He does make adaptations for comics. He changes the way he approaches things. He doesn't write tracking shot,
Right.
And there's still a little bit of that in this Green Hornet script. But Kevin's involved at every step of the writing process. So he'll write that initial script. I'll get it. I'll chop it into panels, give it back to Kevin. He'll tweak it. I'll get it back, do that dummy. And then he'll look at the thumbnails that I've done, and he'll tweak it from there. And then it goes to Jonathan, who will pencil it. And then Kevin takes another pass at it. So, if anything, Kevin's more involved than a normal comic book writer on the project.
Okay, because I think there's some misinformation going on, it was my understanding, and at first I was surprised to hear that, the book was being made from the screenplay and that Kevin really didn't have much to do with it.
Oh, no.
And that's... Kevin, okay, go ahead.
Kevin's copied on every email. I mean...
Okay.
He's involved down to the very last proof we do before it goes to the printer.
And he's talking to you, and he's responding and saying, yeah, do this, do that.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, that's great.
We get a lot of notes, and as it should be, because it's his script and it's his take on the characters. But, yeah, he's there all the time.
Okay, because, I remember years ago when, was it Dark Horse that, took Frank Miller's RoboCop 3?
Right.
And that's the thing. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, buying a screenplay for an unused screenplay and adapting it and everything. And that's why I was like, I'm content with that. I was looking forward to the movie when it was announced, and this is the next best thing, and he's got good people working on it. And, I'm like, oh, Phil's working on it, too. That's cool. Even better.
Yeah.
So, at first I'm like, maybe you're the one that's really adapting the screenplay. But go ahead.
I think retailers and readers can be forgiven for thinking that because they've seen so many of these sort of Hollywood flyby involvements with books.
Sure.
But Kevin's there at every... If anything, we are working from his screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
We are adapting his screenplay.
That's fine.
That said, Kevin's actually adding stuff.
Okay.
So, it's kind of frustrating because, we work together and we'll find some, good cliffhangers. We're like, that's a natural issue break. Let's go there, And so, we work together. We chop the thing into 10 issues. And then Kevin got in there and he started messing around. He's like, I want to add a scene there. I'm like, Kevin, that thing's going to the printer, man. He's like, yeah, but let's add a scene here. And I don't know, I'm not sure anyone's noticed, but number one's 26 pages instead of 22.
Oh, that's cool.
Because we added a scene that wasn't in the screenplay.
Interesting.
So you are going to get the film experience you would have produced, but a little more facets to the story with what Kevin's added.
Okay, and it's going to be, is it 10 issues?
Yeah, 10 issues. But that's another misconception. A lot of people are saying it's a miniseries. It's actually an ongoing. And Kevin's the first 10 issues.
I understand. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, he creates the template from his screenplay. He's very involved in the writing. And then after issue 10, someone else is going to continue the story.
Right.
Interesting. And Andy Parks was on one of the last Around Comics episodes and mentioned that he's got a miniseries coming up that will be a prequel.
Right.
And kind of tell the Van Williams continuity, for a lack of a better comparison.
Yes, it'll be the Britt Reed Sr. storyline for what takes place in the months before that flashback that we have in Kevin mm-hmm. Smith's Green Hornet number one.
Yeah, because in that first issue, the Green Hornet and Kano, let's call it the Silver Age. They kind of have cleaned up the city and are basically ready to retire.
Yeah, and Andy's writing sort of their last caper.
Cool.
Before they retire. And I don't know, this made me feel old because we're setting this thing 20 years ago.
Right.
And we're like, oh my God, 20 years ago. I was an adult 20 years ago. And we think,
I know the
this
feeling.
Is going to be retro. We're going to set this back in 1990. That's not really... it's almost hard to make that a recognizable era in the art,
No, and I've also heard others kind of nitpick and say, well, wait a minute, Van Williams wasn't on a cell phone. And it's like, yeah, but it wasn't 50 years ago.
Right.
It was 20 years ago.
Yeah,
so
it was 20 years ago, yeah.
So, and honestly, Phil, I was a huge fan of the Now Comics Hornet run as well.
Yeah, I like those, too.
I thought they did a hell of a job, and guys like Chuck Dixon and Ron Fortier were doing great work on that. So... I'm a sucker for this character, and it's so funny because I had Matt Wagner on back in November talking about his Golden Age take.
Yeah.
And it was so funny because I'm like, I don't know if the radio shows hold up. And he's like, no, they don't, man.
I've listened to them. Yeah, they're tough. They're tough to get through.
But I still enjoy watching the Van Williams show. And,
yeah.
And we both said, back in the early 90s, we were adults. I was talking with guys that were 10 and 15 years younger than me about the Van Williams Bruce Lee show, and they looked at me like I was nuts when I said, "Well, that show was kind of played more straight than Batman."
Yeah,
and I think they only remember the Colonel Gum. Go ahead,
they only remember that crossover. They
exactly.
Yeah,
and I'm like, no, guys, really? I'm like, this is kind of more like 77 Sunset Strip was, and of course, they've never seen 77 Sunset Strip. But yeah,
you might as well have been describing a stereoscope.
I bet they don't remember GAF Viewmasters, man.
Right. They don't.
But, I'll tell you, really, from the first scene on, it was great. It was great seeing, the billboard open up and the Black Beauty.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited about every iteration that Dynamite is doing with the Hornet, because they're doing the kind of in the same way what Now did in terms of giving everybody what they want. You miss this version of the Hornet, there he is.
Yeah, I think it's... I think there's some hue and cry about oversaturating the market, but what I think they're actually doing is narrow casting.
Yes.
So that you can get, if you dig the classic Green Hornet, go get Matt's book. If you were curious what Kevin would have done with a modern, updated Green Hornet, come get the Kevin Smith book. You don't have to go get them all,
Absolutely.
Although we certainly would appreciate it.
Well, I'll be honest. I'll certainly be sampling everybody and making my choices after that. But, right now I'm very pleased. I mean, God, as we're recording this, Matt's Golden Age first chapter came out the week after yours.
Right.
I thought it was terrific. And I think, man, Aaron Campbell's doing a beautiful job. Jonathan Lau doing a beautiful job on your guys' book as well. Where is he from?
I don't know.
Okay.
I might misspeak, but I think he's from Hong Kong.
Okay. Yeah, and I understand. I mean, you guys are working long distance and everything, so,
Yeah, all I know is his English is impeccable.
Cool.
So I probably lead to the conclusion that he's from Hong Kong, but I don't really know.
Who else? I know you're coming to C2E2.
Yeah.
In Chicago. Are there other Hornet creators that will be at the show?
Andy will be there. Andy
Good
Carter.
Deal. Andy's doing the Cato of your series, miniseries tying into yours.
And Johnny Nitz will be there.
Good. And then he's doing the Golden Age Cato.
He's, yes.
Okay. The great regret, of course, is that the Lone Ranger license is held by somebody different.
Yeah.
And that obviously, you know, hurts any chance of a crossover.
We'll see.
There you go, attaboy.
Attaboy.
Well, you know, now comics kind of found a way to give a wink and a nod to everybody, so.
We'll figure it out.
There you go.
And of course, you know, maybe a Dayton could be reached. And
True, yeah. I mean, obviously, yeah. Dynamite holding both licenses, that would be terrific.
Yeah.
So it's not like Buffy and Angel when they split networks. That's okay.
Right.
No, that's great, man. And switching over to another Golden Age character that's back, the Black Terror.
It's been a blast so far. It was one of those, when they asked me to tackle it, was sort of a blank slate for me. I mean, I knew of the Black Terror from Dan Brereton's series.
Yes, with Chuck Dixon. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and from Terra Obscura.
Yes.
And from the Steranko history of, you know, comics.
That's right.
You know, because I just loved pouring through those and reading about the Golden Age and looking at those postage stamp size covers and letting my imagination run wild as to what was, you know, inside those covers.
Those costumes are so iconic, and they, you know, they stand right up there with the Golden Age Flash or Dr. Fate or anybody you can think of. And
yeah,
and as you say, yeah, there's nothing but possibilities there.
Yeah, I think if Nador had just, you know, ridden it out, Black Terror would be, you know, maybe not Batman big, but he'd be Green Lantern big now.
Interesting.
If they had just keep publishing him, because at the time he was a wildly popular character, and he looks great, and writing him is a joy, because there's sort of been this, at least in the modern series, he's undergone this transformation from, you know, all Gold Age characters had this dual nature where they were squeaky clean, but they were still throwing Nazis off of roofs, you know.
Yeah.
And so the Black Terror, we sort of decided to intensify that in his modern incarnation. So in the original Project Superpowers series, Jim Krueger had this idea that while these superheroes were all in exile since the Golden Age,
mm-hmm.
and while they were in exile, they were in some sort of mystical realm, they were undergoing sort of an intensification of their personalities and their powers. So when they came out, they were sort of Black Terror plus, Pyro Man plus, Green Llama wasn't there. But, you know, all the characters that were in exile
mm-hmm.
came back as themselves intensified. So Black Terror came back as this squeaky clean guy who throws Nazis off of roofs, making him more or less, in my opinion, the Superpowers Universe version of World's Finest in one person. So at the same time, he's their Superman and their Batman.
Interesting.
He's their Boy Scout and their badass mm-hmm. at the same time. And that's made him just a blast to write.
I was wondering if there was a mainstream, you know, a DC or Marvel cipher. And, yeah, I was going to go in there. So that's very interesting, and I can see that now.
Yeah, he's their flagship character, so he's their Superman.
Right.
But he's also their guy who's, you know, willing to trip the bad guy.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I thought of him almost like the Spectre, but I think you're right. I think it is more earthbound in terms of his revenge.
I mean, his power sort of ill-defined. I mean, in the Golden Age, in one issue you could knock him out with a blackjack, and the next issue you could shoot him with a machine gun, and that won't happen. So, you know, you don't really know. But, you know, we sort of set him up as being... I think the word we like to use is unstoppable. You know, he's
sure.
not invincible, but he's unstoppable. He's going to keep coming until he gets you. And so, in a way, it's almost like writing Wolverine too. It's a lot of fun.
That's cool, and that's the great thing, Phil. You're writing so many different characters right now,
yeah.
And different kinds of hero characters. So. Staying in the superpower world. Now, you also did the Masquerade miniseries.
Yeah.
That was your first foray into their world. But
yeah.
And you brought her back for the last arc in Black Terror.
Yeah, she's in the current arc I'm writing as well.
And I also noticed in issue 8 a cover for the current Superpowers book that Kid Terror seems to be crawling out of the grave. So you got to wonder who is the Kid Terror right now with the rest of the teen heroes.
Yep, that's all. That's all the A book. That's all Jim Krueger's territory and Alex Ross's territory. they sort of do a good job of letting me play around the corner, you know.
Sure.
The big story, and if I get too close, they say, hey, we're handling that, you know. Hey, don't bring King Terror back. We're doing that.
Yeah,
so, yeah, it's actually, again, not to beat this, you know, dead horse, but it's like writing a Batman book in that he's such a big character, you can tell between issue stories with him.
Well, and really, they're all out of the urn. So, I mean, you know, like I said, the slate is clean for them to go, yeah, there is room for more stories and everything.
Yeah.
And also, I think, and maybe because your issues are, you know, are they all going to be 4-issue arcs, you think?
Sort of. I mean, the first one was 4. The next one is a one-shot.
Right.
And then there's a 2-issue and a 2-issue that kind of meld together to be a 5-issue arc.
Okay. Well, that's good. I welcome the 2-issue ones because, to be honest, that is my only slight concern is that it seems like even though they're, you know, we've been around for a couple of years now into the Project Superpower world, that things kind of are moving slowly. But I would say if you are reading books like yours, more shit's going on.
Yeah,
so
I'm trying to write it like it's, you know, I hate to sound like I'm a nostalgia nerd, but I'm trying to write it like the books of yore when I was a kid. But there's a continuity, you know, between every issue.
Sure.
But each issue could be read alone, and you can get something out of it. And that's my goal. So even though there are 2-issue arcs, 5-issue arcs, hopefully every issue is a satisfying story.
That's cool. And we had the American Crusader pop up, and we've got a new twist on his character now.
That's part of the fun of working on this project and this property is that Alex Ross is always cooking up new ideas, and he just runs with it. So you'll get sketches in the mail, and you know Alex and Nikki and Joe Rybant will be like, "Can you work this in?" I'll be like, "Hell yeah!" I'm excited. I got to see it before anybody else.
Well, and there's another facet of World's Finest where the Terror book is it by design that there will always be a couple of the other characters in the books?
More or less. I mean, because there's so much story to pack into the main Project Superpowers book, Alex really wants to make a point of seeing the other heroes interact with Black Terror in Black Terror's book.
Okay.
Making that the sort of regular Project Superpowers universe book. So an issue I just wrote, gosh, what do we have? We had Black Terror, Masquerade, Pyroman, The Flame, Green Llama, and the Targeteers were in the last 2-issue I wrote. So, you know, they're always going to crop up here and there.
That's cool. And I noticed that it looks like Captain Midnight, and I forget what they're calling him now. Is that Sky King or?
I don't want to say because I'll forget too, and I'll say some copyrighted name.
Okay. Well, and again, I think we're the only ones that are going to remember or recognize that it's Captain Midnight, us and Roy Thomas. But
yeah. Roy Thomas, his ears are prickling right now.
Either that or he's getting, like, an urge to drink some Ovaltine. You know, one of the two. But but that's – well, it's cool because in a lot of ways it reminds me of not so much Justice, although I guess Justice kind of has that kinship with what, you know, Jim and Alex did. But it's like all of their Earth-X books were like a big opera going on.
Yeah.
And it really was like, you know, a very apocalyptic and such high odds and everything. And – your book is the television show.
Right. My book is the chance for you to see why they're heroes.
There you go.
Well, no, seriously.
I know what you mean, though, yeah.
It's sort of like I love The Dark Knight. I love that movie, okay? But I wish I would have seen more of Batman being Batman.
You bet. You
know, being a good guy. Instead, he's in the drama right away, the story of what's happening to Batman. And that's sort of what Project Superpowers is. It's the bigger story. It's how, you know, it's what's happening to these heroes. And what I get to do with Black Terror and what I got to do with Masquerade was slow down, back up, and show you why they're heroes. Show you how they're interacting with our world today and how they're trying to find their role as heroes, you know, in a world that, you know, is 60 years ahead of them.
And Alex is going to be in Chicago at C2E2. Will Jim be there as well?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but I know Alex will be.
I was really thrilled when it was announced that the project was underway, and he's tapping good guys. Guys like you, my friend Doug Klaba is doing the two-page origins in the back of Project Superpowers. So
those are pretty.
Yeah, they sure are, and it's a great opportunity, again, to take these, you know, two-dimensional characters and add some depth and give them a story that all these other, you know, regular mainstream heroes are enjoying having good writers and artists doing nowadays, too. It's good to see these characters getting dusted off.
They're a lot of fun.
Very cool, man. Well, you know, yeah, I think you can count on me bugging you guys about the Hornet and about Project Superpowers at C2E2.
Sounds good.
But on to other things like the Anchor.
Yes.
Man.
I have more things I'm working on.
Yeah, this is a long conversation, Phil. There's a lot to talk about, you know, and we're going to get to the darkness eventually as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Anchor. Now, what led you to create this character?
It's all to do with the artist, Brian Cirilla.
Oh, okay.
Who I think is a super talented guy. And I've been looking for a way to work with that guy for like a year. And what I usually do when I'm, you know, find a new artist and trying to hook up with him, I have this list of like 30 pitches of books I want to get done before I die. And I send it to the artist and say, pick one, you know, and that'll be yours and we'll work on it. And I sent Brian my list, and he's the first guy to come back and say, I don't want to do any of these.
Interesting.
And I was like, oh, well. And he's like, well, I really want to do something iconic. And all your heroes are everymen. You know, they're guys thrown into bizarre situations, but they're normal guys. And he goes, I wanted to do something bigger than life and iconic. And I said, okay, kid, you know. And I went back to the drawing board, and I was just noodling around in my head, and I think I was either reading an art history book or watching a travel show. I can't remember which one. But the idea of anchorite monks came up. And these are monks that were so dedicated to monasticism that they didn't even want to interact with other monks. They walled themselves up in the foundations of churches. And they had a little slit of a window that opened to the altar so they could take communion. And they had a little slit that opened to the outside world so they could get light and air. And that's it. They lived in that cell for the rest of their lives.
Wow.
I mean, they mortared themselves in. Okay, so that was their tomb.
Jesus.
And that's commitment.
I would say so.
And I thought, you know, what would happen to a guy? You know, of course, being a nerd, everything turns into a possible superhero origin for me. So I'm like, what happens if a guy gets in there and he just meditates on, you know, meeting out punishment to the enemies of God, you know?
Yes.
And he's a guy that maybe has a bit of an unclean past himself. Maybe he's an ex-Viking, or maybe he's an ex, you know, medieval prize fighter or something. And he's got a lot to atone for. And while he's there, he finds his soul has, you know, his prayers have been answered. His soul has been split from his body, and his soul sent to hell to kick the asses of demons from now to the end of time. And that's the Anchor. Now, he's got a little mystery in his life, which is, at some point, he wanders away from his post. His body wanders away from his post in this church. And there's this little breach between hell and earth, and some creatures escape onto earth. So while his soul is fighting demons in hell, his body's left to track down these demon offspring that are wandering around on earth. So he's fighting a two-front war all the time. And every wound his soul suffers in hell shows up on his body. So he more or less looks like, you know, a hulking bruise, you know, a 7-foot scar.
Yeah.
Walking around fighting monsters on earth.
Well, that's there.
That's the Anchor.
That's cool. And there are aspects of, you know, and forgive me, but like Hellboy and the Hulk and, you know, I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, those kind of visuals are there. And and I mean, you know, I like where Brian's art is going too. What led you to Brian's art?
Where did I see it? Well, I think he showed it to me. I think he showed it to me in San Diego.
Oh, cool.
And it wasn't published work. He showed me his portfolio.
Okay.
And if you know about Brian's work at all, you know it's like some sort of mashup of Jeff Smith, Wally Wood, and Mike Mignola.
Yep.
And so he cartoons with that whimsy of Jeff Smith, but he's got those heavy blacks of a Mignola, and he's got the inking style, you know, the lighting style of Wally Wood. So you don't let a guy like that get away.
That's interesting. Eric Powell came to mind as well.
Yeah, exactly. Eric Powell's very similar. Eric Powell cartoons, you know, he pencils, he lays out with whimsy, but then he finishes with heaviness.
Yeah.
And that's what gives you that a very satisfying look to his work. And Brian's got that same thing going on. Hillary Barta's got it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't want to let Brian get away, so I created the anchor for him. I said, this is a guy who exists. He's the Hulk with the soul of Gandhi, and he exists to kill monsters. You know?
Sure.
So he's never going to harm a human being, never going to let harm come to a human being. But it's his mission to kill these monsters that he let loose. And that's what we're at on issue 8 right now we're working on, and we're having a blast with it.
Very cool. Now, Iceland is his place of origin as far as where the story begins.
Yeah, the story begins in Iceland, and then it jumps around. We go to Scotland, we go to Italy, we go to the United States, and we wind up back in Iceland.
Okay, and I was just wondering, I mean, Iceland has found itself, you know, on the front pages.
Yeah, I hope we didn't start that.
Well, and you know, well, no, but I was wondering, and I know that this is a supernatural book, and as you say, a globetrotting book as well, but will the, you know, current problems in Iceland, you know, come up in the book at all?
I wish we could have reflected that, because the book's taken a strange turn, so he's, I don't want to spoil it for people.
Okay.
But they're not exactly on Earth.
Well, and that, and so, given the events of issues 4 and 5, yeah, yeah. I, you know, yeah. And that was going to be, you know, the next point, obviously, you know, the his sidekick. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we're ready to call her a romantic interest or not.
Yeah.
Hofi Eric's daughter?
Yeah, Hofi Eric's daughter. Yeah. It's an Icelandic name.
I would say so. Definitely. And yeah, she seems to have some perception abilities that go beyond, you know,
yeah,
normal humans.
She seems to be able to do things that normal humans can't. And she seems to know more than she should.
Mm-hmm.
And she's his sort of dedicated companion. And we're playing with the idea that she's attracted to him and he to her. And that's sort of a problem for him, because originally he lived in such a brutal world, you know, 800 years ago when he was a normal human. Such a, you know, heartless kind of life is cheap world, that it's an easy world to turn your back on, you know, and become a monk. But now he lives in a world where, you know, television and, you know, as horrible as we think our world is today, it's better than it was 800 years ago.
Sure.
Okay. And there are people who will accept him, even looking the way he does, which is new to him, too. So it's harder to turn his back on this world, especially when there's somebody in it that cares for him. So that's sort of what's the conflict driving him right now.
That's interesting. And you know, great excuse to come up with crazy demons. I was wondering how many of them are born of, you know, fine art examples of, like, Norse mythology or, you know, things like that. I mean, is there like, you know, a good source material to look at designs and say, ooh, look what, you know, so-and-so did back in the 1100s, and we can build on that?
I think probably that's the place we diverge from Hellboy, because you see Mike do that a lot, and we don't. We tend to be a little more far out and trust my imagination and just wing it, you know.
Cool.
So, you know, I said for the first issue, I mean, for the first actual 4 issues, we have monsters that reflect the nature of the place where they were conceived. So the Iceland monster is sort of a walking glacier, you know, a geothermal glacier, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Spouting steam, made of ice. In the second issue, we fight a creature from Scotland that's sort of a centaur elk man, you know, or deer man that's running through one of the deer preserves of Scotland. In the third issue, we have a creature that's based on the catacombs underneath Rome. So we try to find something unique about the place and then exploit that. But outside of that, it's really just Brian's fevered imagination.
Very cool. And tell me about Blood Facts. Is it Blood Fact? No, Blood Far.
Oh, Blood Far.
Blood Far. It's the comic strip that's in the back of the book.
Did I set you off by saying Brian's fevered imagination?
Yes.
And then he said, yeah, that Blood Farm. Yeah, nobody knows what that is, even Brian.
Was that something that he made as a webcomic, or?
Yeah, it's just something he did for fun, to kill time, and when he knew we were going to have a letter call, because we felt that was really important to have a letter call.
Yes.
And when he knew we were going to have that, he's like, I want to run that. And we're like, okay, man, you know, as long as there's no profanity, you know, because a lot of people don't notice. I don't know if anyone notices, but we haven't taken pains to make it an all-ages book, but we certainly haven't had gratuitous nudity or a language in that book yet, because we want it to sort of be accessible to, like, preteen readers.
Okay, so like a PG-13, basically?
Yeah, even though it's super violent.
Sure. Well, yeah, but it's comic book, you know, but, and yeah, and I mean, it's monsters fighting, so.
So we're like, so every issue we do Blood Farm, and then we do a recommended listening.
Yes.
For each issue. And we have to always edit Brian's recommended listening.
Ah.
Because it's always, you know, some reference to bestiality or.
Okay.
Some horrific satanic sacrifice in these songs. And we're like, come on, Brian. Kid might read this book, man.
So, oh, yeah.
No, but it's a great. And Brian is actually a very mild mannered, sweet guy.
Very cool.
We're actually two of the same. When people meet us, they're very disappointed.
You're gentlemen.
Yeah, they're always bummed out.
Dude, you're not a biker. You should be a biker.
You look like someone's dad. Because I am someone's dad.
I was going to say, you are someone's dad. Absolutely, man. The strip reminds me of those weird trading cards that used to have, like, really bizarre monsters and stuff. I don't even know where they came from because I was such a little kid when they were coming out.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
But, yeah, you know, I mean, it's just weird for the sake of being weird.
Yeah, it's just Brian cutting loose.
That's cool. That's great. Now, you mentioned the letter column, and really, from the first issue, you really called out and said, hey, you know, let's build a community. How's that going?
It's going great. We tend to get, especially compared to the amount of readers we have, at least legal readers. We get a lot of letters. So
cool.
It's pretty cool.
Interesting. And, you know, Ross is Ross Ritchie at Boom is really one of my favorite publishers because he clearly is excited about the books that he puts out.
Yeah, we went with him over a couple of other places that made offers on the book because he was so enthusiastic about it. And because he basically, you know, he said, hey, listen, you know, you're coming to me. We're going to share this property. You're going to have editorial free reign to do what you want to do.
That's fantastic.
And I said, that's what I want to hear. You know,
but definitely.
The other two places that will remain nameless didn't make that same offer. You know, one of them wanted me to fire Brian.
No kidding.
I was like, what's the point of that? And this, you're performing a charmectomy on this. You know, the whole point is to see Brian draw these things.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's... So Boom was the place that said, you know, come here, do your thing, we'll get behind you, push you as hard as we can. And I have to say, they've hustled harder for this book than any publisher I've ever had for a creator-owned project.
Very cool. Well, and it, will we see a time where you might be drawing an arc or an issue or whatever?
Well, I drew a cover.
Yes, and, okay.
But, you know, I will say that I've always told people I tend to write books that I wouldn't be the right artist for. But I
okay.
probably could draw the anchor.
I was going to say, Phil, because among the stuff, I mean, I know you did some darkness too, but I could see you drawing this character.
Yeah, I probably could. And, you know, there might be a special or an annual coming up that I probably will draw.
Okay. Very cool. And will Brian be coming to C2E2?
I don't think so. He's out in Oregon.
Okay. Well, yeah,
so
he was.
It's kind of a haul for him.
Were you guys together for Emerald City?
Yes, we were sat next to each other.
Very nice.
Signed a bunch of books. In fact, Emerald City, the pro badge was an anchor drawing that Brian did.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Very cool. That's great. No, the first trade is out, right?
Yes, it is. It's called The Five Furies, and it's out now.
Excellent. And that collects 1 through 4 or 1 through 5?
1 through 4. 1 through 4.
Okay.
That's something to pay attention to. It's called The Five Furies, but it's only 4 monsters. And that's a little cliffhanger leading into the next arc.
There you go. And right, and I've read up through 5 now, and again, the events of 5 lead us to believe that, you know, that can't be the end of Hofi,
right.
Or the anchor for that matter, obviously. So
right. I promise in the next arc you will find out who the fifth fury is.
Okay.
Find out what happened to Hofi, and you'll actually find that the truth behind their relationship.
That's cool. Yeah, you teased that 6 is going to be an origin issue also.
Yeah.
So
and it is. 6 is all origin, and 7 is all drama, and 8 is all bloodbath.
back to superpowers for a second, because I meant to ask this earlier. Like, how does that work? As you say, you work, you know, in the corners of Jim and Alex's plans. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, are you how often are you pitching arcs, or are they coming to you and saying, "This is what we've got mapped out for the year. Tell stories around these moments." And
what was cool is that they let me pitch a year. They let me pitch a year of my ideas to them, and if Alex likes it, you're going to get to do it. And Alex liked what I wanted to do, and you know, what I wanted to do with this year of Black Terror was really get into his head and see what it's like for basically a superhero who is the Clint Eastwood character from Gran Torino. see that guy adjust to the 21st century. And sort of come to grips with what he's lost, you know, because even though physically he's, you know, probably 30, he's an old man in our world. Everything he understands is gone. And he's got to come to grips with the life he can never have back. He can't go back and, you know, woo his girlfriend anymore.
Right.
She's 80, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody he knew or loved is dead, so except these other superheroes.
Right.
So for him, it's a matter of, and not only that, it's getting back to the civilian identity that he had that he can't go back to. That guy's dead.
The pharmacist.
So, yeah, Bob Benson's dead. You know, he's been missing for 60 years. There's no Bob Benson anymore.
Right.
And physically, we find that his new costume, his new persona is the Black Terror. He cannot remove. He's always the Black Terror. He can modify it so that he can move. He can move around in public unmolested. So,
okay,
you're into a black trench coat and shades, but it's always there. He's always the Black Terror.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's a lot of the next arc that I'm working on right now is about coming to grips with letting go of Bob Benson.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And you know, the whole series in general, or the line, is very political as well.
Yeah.
And I like that. And I think at a time when some superhero books are afraid to get political, just talk to Matt Fraction about things in general. And he said, you know, sometimes it can look silly if politics are used in the wrong way with superheroes.
Yeah, it looked like Nomad from the 70s Gap.
Well,
I
had Englehart on a couple weeks before that. And
I dug that, but it can look, you know, that can look dated.
Sure.
Too specific. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, when we were 10 at the time, it sure as hell looked cool.
Oh, to me, it was awesome.
Absolutely, man. No, him and Jerry Conway totally blew my mind as a kid. You know,
yeah.
Conway killing Gwen Stacy and watching Nixon blow his brains out in
Cap. Nixon. Yeah, that's a little. See, that's the thing that gets me. That's what I like about Project Superpowers. It's generally just anti-authoritarian.
Yes.
And when the book started coming out, that seemed like an indictment of the Bush administration. You know, and I guess the shoe's on the other foot for, you know, and so there's some people that can take that to be, you know, chafing against the Obama administration.
Sure.
But if you know anything about Alex or me or Jim, that's not accurate.
No, I understand. I read Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah, I'm on board with Alex.
No, I'm, you know, and I'm lean left as well, so I understand, and I... No,
I don't want my fine conservative fans to keep buying my comics.
Well, but, you know, as
I
you say...
I just found out that, like, one of the most conservative politicians in Iowa reads my books, and it blew my mind. I was like, wow, I guess that's cool.
That's like Straczynski said, he found out that Bush and Karl Rove were Babylon 5 fans.
It means there's something universal about your work.
Certainly.
And that's always appreciated.
Well, and as you say, the politics in Project Superpowers is against authority.
It's against authority. It's not against liberalism or conservatism. It's about, I don't think anybody, you know, I don't know anyone who's pro-totalitarianism.
Right. Well, and also those values that were so clear of the World War II era. You know, it's tough living by those rules these days.
Oh, yeah.
For both sides of the spectrum.
Oh,
so, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I mean, it is a different world. And I think that should play into who they are and what they're up against in the modern era.
Oh, definitely. And, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but the political authority in the Project Superpowers universe is run by a supervillain. I mean, the president is a supervillain. So, I mean, it's... We're not trying to say too much about, you know, the current system, you know, because there are no supervillains
that we are aware of. Exactly.
Yeah.
Although I think Dick Cheney probably has a secret headquarters with a moat.
He might.
I'm guessing he does.
He's got the sneer for it.
Exactly.
But, outside of that, you know, I don't want to. I think people can read too much into that. I think it's just like a hearty question authority kind of thing.
I hear you. And then The Darkness, a good combination of fantasy and crime, and taking a paramilitary kind of turn in the most recent story.
Yeah, we for people who don't know, we've taken great pains over the last year to establish a new arch villain for Jackie in a character called the Sovereign, who's a character that's been alive since about 4,000 years ago, but cursed to only be able to inhabit effigies of himself. So he can only animate a sculpture of himself or a frieze of himself that was created during his reign as an earthly monarch. So, but that said, he's a master manipulator. He's got a worldwide network of real-world resources. And so he's a formidable villain for Jackie. And so Jackie is a sort of assembled an A-team of sorts of other lowlifes and
yes.
criminals. And they go around the world kind of striking back at the Sovereign's network and destroying these statues of his that he can inhabit before he can inhabit them and sort of leaving him with no home. And in that way, Jackie's hoping to get to a final showdown with the very last Sovereign body on Earth and pay him back for the hell that he put him through a couple years ago in the book.
And obviously, this kind of story is going to dovetail pretty nicely in what's going on as far as the overarching event that's coming at Top Cow.
Yeah, Artifact, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, go ahead. Tell us what you can about the plans.
I'm not authorized to say too much about it, except for to say it's going to give readers a cohesive picture of all the artifacts in the dark in the Top Cow universe.
Call it the Darkness Universe.
Yeah.
Why not? That's all right. Philip, I'm sure, would understand.
Yeah, if Mars is on, he can call it the Witchblade Universe.
There you go. Exactly.
But it also shows you how all these artifacts interrelate, and it gives you an idea of the universes that came before, that maybe there's a deeper history to the Top Cow universe. And when people say this changes everything, you know, every time they say that.
Right.
You know, Marvel and DC.
Sure.
It changes everything. You can't change everything. You know Steve Rogers is coming back. You know Bruce Wayne's coming back. Top Cow is small enough that, you know, we don't have to bring Jackie Estacado back.
You know, interesting.
We don't have to bring Sarah Pazini back. We can do what we want. And when we say this artifacts changes everything, it really does. The books reset, more or less, and you see a new status quo. That said, they're going to be recognizable as the Darkness and Witchblade and Magdalena, but they're going to go through some heavy changes as a result of Artifact.
Very cool. Have you been in contact with one of your biggest fans in Chicago?
Lance?
Indeed, Lance Briggs,
yeah,
Chicago
yeah.
Bear, and around comics listeners are well aware of this fact, but some of the Word Balloon crowd may not be. But he's come right out and said that his favorite character from the 90s is the Darkness, and he's
it's cool.
Yeah,
I don't know if I'm supposed to tease this. I don't know if C2E2 wants me teasing this, but I think Ron and I will be on a panel with Lance. I'm not kidding.
I'm aware of this. All right, that's all right. No, I think it's excellent. Actually, their program is the programming is out for C2E2, so
okay.
I'm sure it's among the points. Or if not, you know, I think the buzz has already been put out there in Chicago.
We might actually have more Bears fans in the audience than comic book fans that day.
But that's a good chance to convert a lot of football fans into
sure.
Darkness fans.
Yeah, I mean, who's gonna, you know, if it's cool enough for Lance, it's cool enough for, you know, fans.
Well, and you know, I'm not a big fantasy guy, but I am a big crime guy, and that's what I like about Jackie, because he even approaches the Sovereign like a crime boss.
Yeah, that's sort of exactly what we're doing. We want it to look like we want it to look and feel like a gang war.
Yes,
except for both guys can do magic stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah, I don't. You know, it's funny that you say it's a fantasy book, because I never think about it that way. I was thinking about it as a horror book with crime stuff in it. And it's a neat to hear another perspective on it.
Well,
I tend not to think of it that way.
Well, and that's just my front label for it, because I still do think of it as a crime book, and that's what I look forward to. Just like with Witchblade, when I read it, it's a police procedural that has definitely magic in it.
Yeah.
And I think that's great, and that's my anchor for those books and everything, is the gritty side. And, you know, it's there, and that's the really cool thing. Silvestri's beautiful art and everything, I think, gave a very specific perception of the Top Cow universe, but guys like you and Ron Mars are really showing there's an edge there as well. And I mean, you'll definitely get your eye candy, but the other good news is too, there's some real solid storytelling going on and really strong stuff for fans of those genres.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for. I mean, it's always going to look the way it looks, and I think that's what the real diehard Top Cow fans come back for, that sort of standard of design and art that's in the book. But I, you know, as long as we've got them, why not tell them a good story?
Absolutely.
And so that's our goal. Our goal is to tell. And again, I always think of darkness stories as horror stories, because even though there are magic elements, and Jackie has fantastic powers, never seems to work out for him. He always seems to come up on the short end of the stick.
True.
So it is a horror book, and although he sometimes is dishing out the violence, in the end, he's the victim of the darkness, and he's fighting. He's sort of that, you know, the last girl alive running down the hallway, you know, trying to escape the darkness. He's the lone survivor of the darkness. And that's sort of the angle I've taken with the book this whole time.
Has writing these kind of stories expanded your reading as far as any possible research or you know? Okay.
Yeah, especially when it comes to whenever I put Jackie in, he's done a lot of globetrotting too lately. So
yes.
You know, I'll read up on the places I sent him and the conflicts I throw him in the middle of. Not to the degree like Josh Dysart has, but, you know.
Sure.
I still, you know, I'll read up on things. I'm not going to go to the Congo anytime soon.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. He really did go out there and see it for it. Yeah.
So,
Jesus, yeah.
But, you know, I'll read up on any sort of mess that I put him in. And, you know, I really try to go out of my way to make sure every time Jackie comes, like, the issue that I'm working on right now, he's up against a former Russian mobster who's turned art collector. He's retired and he's become an art collector. But he hasn't quite given up his mobster's ways. So he's become the biggest badass art collector in the world. You know, he's kind of a shady guy. And he has this Rasputin-like enforcer, you know. And for me, that's the fun of it. I gotta come up with something weird, some weird spin to put on it. So he's got this guy who's like a 7 foot tall Rasputin in a sleeveless shirt covered with scars who's deaf. And we don't know why he's deaf, but that plays into what comes up in the story. And for me, I've always got to find that little quirk, you know, to make darkness stories interesting. Because like I said, it's too easy to fall back in that. I don't know. Selling the darkness to people is like selling heavy metal to people, you know? Some people are just say, hey, look, I'm not into metal. I'm not going to like that.
Right.
And you can say, wait, no, this is different. This Mastodon album is different, you know? And people will be like, yeah, it's still metal. I'm not interested. Well, that's what we're trying to do with Jackie. We're saying, hey, listen, the metal is still there for you metalheads, but we're going to have a little different angle, you know, and try to bring in the other people too and see if we can convert them. So that's, for me, that's always the goal, is to find a twist to throw into those stories.
And tell me about working with Michael. I mean, you know, amazing artist. And,
We will never keep him down on the farm because he's so brilliant. And it's been announced that he's, in fact, gone from the darkness.
Oh, man.
Yeah, 83, we announced that in Seattle, that 83 is his last issue. And he goes out with a bang. It's beautiful.
It sure is. Absolutely.
But the next issue, 84, is drawn by a promising young newcomer named Will Spartacio.
I saw the tease on that. Yes, that's awesome.
And then we have a two-issue arc drawn by Sheldon Mitchell, who is coming off of that pilot season book, Delph, they did with Kirkman and Silvestri.
Oh, cool.
And then we have another two-issue arc that I know the artist, but we're not allowed to announce him.
Okay.
And then we're looking for the guy who will come on and do the last year of my run, you know, straight through. And there's some really exciting candidates. I don't want to spoil anything by saying who they may or may not be. But, yeah, if we land one of these guys, any one of them, I'll be excited.
Will it have wound up being a three-year run then, Phil?
Or yeah, that's my goal, yeah, with a three-year run.
Very cool. That's great. Are you? Do you want to stay in the Top Cow universe, or have you got some
definitely.
Other?
I love working there. So
cool.
What I'd really like to do is create a new property for them, you know, because they have, you know, the Darkness and the Witchblade are their sort of their two tentpoles.
Right.
And Magdalene is prominent, but I feel like, you know, there's room to expand there. There's room to create some, you know, because Cyberforce is there, too.
Right. Well, we're seeing that, too, with Angelus and Broken Trinity. Is that the...
Yeah.
And I was wondering if Jackie will be, you know, running into them. I mean, it seems destined to happen.
Actually, yeah, he's running into, in Wills Portacia's issue, he runs into what we call the Hunter-Killer B team.
Oh, good.
The Hunter-Killer AAA team. the guys who can't quite, the guys who aren't quite good enough to be, you know, full-time hunter-killer agents for one reason or another. And it's a chance to play with that sort of dynamic that Mark Waid created.
Sure. Very cool.
And, I still think there's room in that universe for, you know, maybe a straight-up superhero book. Maybe something that's not so keyed into the artifact, not so keyed into the supernatural element. Or maybe a straight crime book. You know, who knows? But there's room in that universe.
That's cool. That's cool. And you got enthusiastic people running the place, too, so...
Oh, yeah. In fact, when I say Michael Broussard's leaving Darkness, he's not leaving Top Cow.
Good.
He's going to be working on that high-profile crossover series Artifact.
And oh, okay.
Another book that I'm not allowed to mention. And then he and I actually are talking about creating... That when I say create something for Top Cow, that's something that Michael and I are talking about doing.
Terrific. That's really cool. Hey, man, I'm really glad you're getting some opportunities to write because, you know, the things that I have read in the past, and they've been very different, you know, from straight-up superhero stuff to the postcards book that you did, you know, you did the short story there, The Coffin, so many other different things, Fire Breather.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's I'm glad you're getting your opportunities to write more, man, because...
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what you're doing, which is very cool. And it's
I hope. Or at least it'll be fun watching me learn.
Well, but I think, you know, you already learned the storytelling, you know, art tools.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if anything, it is much easier, I think, for you to maybe write in this language.
I never saw them as two different tasks. I saw them as different points on the same continuum, you know. It's all about storytelling. And sometimes you're using the words and sometimes you're using pictures.
Well, and, you know, and I always forget that, too, because you're right. Obviously, even when you were doing it, you know, as a kid or whatever, you're certainly creating your own story, so you were writing.
Yeah, I've been doing that my whole time. I mean, I did it all through college. I did it all through high school. It's just that commercially, my drawing was more demonstrably useful to publishers earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I got work at. And to me, that was fine, you know. But I've been writing the whole time. I mean, I wrote The Wretch 15 years ago. You know,
cool.
Or longer. It was a long time ago.
Wow.
I created it in 93. So, you know, I have been writing all this time, too, just not work for hire.
I gotcha. Do you have a closet of, you know, stories that you're going to pull out and maybe put out there digitally and, you know, breathe some new life in them and stuff?
You know what? It's funny you mentioned that, but I was just thinking the other day that I have actually a big catalog.
Yeah.
That I could put online. I mean, I have... something like 400 pages of Wretch stories that I own, that I could put online. You know, we own Firebreather. We could do anything we want.
There you go.
So yeah, it's something I've considered, and it's definitely something I'm going to pursue because I think it helps build your fan base if they can come read your work.
That's what I mean.
Call me crazy.
Well, exactly, and this is a real opportunity for everyone really to go in the closet and say, okay, yeah, what, you know.
Yeah,
what did we put out in the 90s when things were really bad and, you know, there was 10% of the audience?
Yeah. I have no problem with that. I mean, I think someday we will do a Wretch Omnibus someday.
Cool.
But, you know, until then, why not throw it out there and let people see it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that, yeah, eventually I will do that. But I kind of want to put out trades. You know, the Wretch trades have come out. They've come and gone. But I have other properties like Golly that I own.
Right. Or 13 Steps? Is that
13 Steps again.
Very cool.
And that's been traded up, so I'd be willing to put that online.
Cool.
But stuff like Golly, I want it to have a healthy shot at a trade first.
Okay.
Then I'll probably put it on my.
Well, you know, and I had a similar conversation with Philip, too, in terms of you don't want to cannibalize your own audience by putting, you know, everything out digitally and at the same time, but...
Yeah. I think I'd like to give the books a shot first, just for the, you know, for the chance of maybe making my artists some of their money back.
You know? Gotcha.
Because it's rough. And,
no.
Any trade sales are sort of the last little toehold we have in any sort of financial success in publishing. So, you know, doing that is cool. And then we'll put them online and just let people read them.
Is there time to draw? Or, you know, are we going to hear about any art stuff for you coming up?
I just started thinking about that because I haven't drawn since October, which was the last issue of The Darkness that I drew.
Okay.
And that's the longest I've gone. I mean, I've drawn for myself. I've drawn concept sketches and things. And con sketches at shows.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the longest I've gone without an assignment in my life since I was 20. And it's starting to itch now. So I don't know. I think I probably will, maybe even at C2E2, look for a miniseries to draw at Marvel or DC. Just to sort of keep my... it helps your writing projects when people know who you are.
Exactly.
So it might pay to actually remind people that I'm out here.
No, I think that, you know, I think you're double the threat.
Yeah, I'd love to find a thing. I mean, I'd love to find a thing in Marvel or DC that I could write and draw. You know, that would be. That's the dream project, of course, is to find a. You know, let me go off in a corner with Ragman and, you know, do the Dark Knight of Ragman somewhere.
That's cool. Well, you know, and I'm curious about this, Phil, because I've seen a couple artists say this online. Ethan Van Sciver was very clear about this when he was on my show a couple months ago. And he talked about the relationship sometimes with writers. And I'm sure it depends on the writer that you work with. But do you feel that in the current era of comics that where the artists had the upper hand 20 years ago that it's become that, you know, unbalanced in the writer's favor?
Oh, completely.
Okay.
I mean, I don't say that as if it's a bad thing. I mean, stories at the fore, which is fine by me. But yeah, the new superstars are writers, definitely. And you know, you and I both know that 15 years ago, that was not the case.
It was the exact opposite.
Yeah, it was the exact opposite, which, you know, in some ways it's cool because it means the events are bigger than who's you know, producing them.
Right.
But I'm sort of missing that, you know, there's no real auteur anymore. You know, there's no Frank Miller lying around.
Right.
From
an art standpoint or from
from an art and writing standpoint.
Okay.
I'm doing both.
Yes. Well.
You know what I mean?
I mean,
those people exist, but they're off doing, you know, independent books or their own graphic novels.
Right.
I mean, and a Frank Miller story, too, by the way.
Sure.
But what I mean is, it doesn't seem like, I mean, Tony Daniels is as close as we have to a Marvel or DC trusting somebody to run the whole show.
And, you know, I hated his Battle for the Cowl, but I have to say, I went back and read that first Batman arc. It's good.
Yeah.
It is good.
And, you know, I'm sure, you know, who knows how many editorial edicts Tony has to work under.
Well, I'm curious to find out. Yeah, I'm hoping to talk to him.
Something else I'm not prepared for when it comes to working at Marvel and DC. I always had this idea that I want to work at Marvel and DC again as a writer and an artist. But I dread having to make my stuff fit into whatever company-wide crossover is going on.
I understand that.
To my mind, and you and I are roughly the same age, I'm sure, that all the great comics of our lifetime were comics that Marvel or DC had given up on.
Yep.
And said, you know what? F it. This isn't working. Let Miller have that Daredevil book. You know? Who knows? What are these cockamamie X-Men? Let that Claremont Cochran kid have fun with it. You know?
No, you're right.
And that's when the exciting stuff happens.
Grell on Warlord, you know, the weird little, you know, Joe Orlando books from the 70s and stuff.
Starlin on Warlock.
It came when
the guys in the Herman Miller chairs backed off and let the kids in their basements do their thing. And I'd love to see some more of that creep back in. I mean, I know, these are forces bigger than you or I can
sure
probably deal with, you know, the sales forces. how Marvel and DC approach their marketing. But to me, I wish they would carve out a little more room for that stuff.
You're right, and I think it's driving some creators away. I mean, Englehart's like, I can't think in terms of what I'm going to do for the next 12 months. He goes, if I plot that far ahead, he goes, it gets boring.
Yeah.
So.
You're never going to see Mutts anymore. You're never going to see a Werewolf by Night roll out again.
Yeah. You
know, those little quirky little things can't happen anymore. I mean, and honestly, creators who have ideas for great characters, keep them.
I understand that.
Don't give them to Marvel and DC anymore.
Sure.
Even if they work there. They're doing their good ideas at Icon or Image or someplace else.
No, I think that's smart, and I think especially in today's environment and stuff, why not create it for yourself?
Yeah, but it would take very, very minimal effort from Marvel or DC to scout the right talent to say, hey, you know what? We want you to cut loose. We want you to be that creative force. Cut loose, do your thing, give us new characters. I'm willing to do it. You know, there are people out there willing to do it.
Well, and I do think there are editors that at least offer the ability for the great miniseries to come out. Because yeah. I do think that beyond marketing as well, there seems to be a line that Marvel is like, look, if it doesn't make this number, we're not going to continue it. I know that it's a fan favorite.
I know that better than anybody.
Exactly. There you go.
Ant-Man was one of those books.
There you go. Exactly. Now, who was your editor on Ant-Man?
Aubrey Sitterson, who is no longer there.
Okay.
He works for the WWE now.
Interesting. I didn't know that's where he went. That's wild.
Yeah.
Wow. Is it a man or a woman?
Aubrey's a dude, yeah.
Okay, because I remember
he works for Kirkman now still.
Oh, okay.
He had Kirkman's Image book.
Okay, and yeah, wasn't his Destroyer was one of the last things, I think, too, right? Okay.
The running joke with Kirkman that he tries to make people believe Aubrey's a lady.
Well, I just remember the Bread song, of course.
Well, I always thought he was a dude, but I always thought he was a brother. And then when I met him, he's like a little mini Conan. He's like a 5'4" Conan.
Interesting. That's funny. Well, and I was going to say Mark Panizia, it sounds like, is an editor that will.
Believe me, I think they're. I trust the sensibilities of a lot of the editors up there. But I don't know if people talk to you about this, but those guys are all worked overwork. I mean, they're working their behinds off and just keeping up with the projects they have going. And I don't think they have the breathing room that guys had in the 80s or the 90s. Well, let's not talk about the 90s.
Yeah. Too much breathing room. Nobody's around.
The editors didn't have the breathing room that they had then to say, you know, let's try something new and let's give it time. It doesn't exist anymore, and God knows why. And again, you and I aren't going to figure out here, but it's something I wish Marvel and DC would take a few more shots.
And you wonder, with them both coming under heavier corporate, you know, ownership. I mean, you know, and I don't know. I know Marvel's claiming a Pixar-like relationship with Disney,
and
certainly Warner Brothers, I think, has the right creative people. That produce very popular books, running the store and everything, and also guys that have a great appreciation for the quirky books too.
Oh yeah, I think that's there, but I don't know. I just like to see it's pie in the sky. I'm sure.
No, I'm with you.
But they have to say to themselves, "Where's our Harry Potter coming from? Where's our new Harry Potter coming from?"
Yes.
And it's not the guys that are. I mean, God bless them. It's not the guys you have there now. Because they're too smart for that, you know.
Yeah.
Anything new, they're going to own themselves, and they have to figure out some way to give the creators equity, and bring them in to create new franchises for them. Because look, if you put me on Batman, you'd be getting a new Batman villain every month. You know, I would just be, you know, I would say, hey, here's an opportunity. I'm going to seize it. You know.
Sure.
I'm gonna run with it, and you know, I'm going to pull out all the stops because. This is what I dreamt of doing when I was 12 years old. And in a way, I'm still doing, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm still doing it. But, I think too many creators are reticent about handing over their great ideas to the corporations.
Well, and young guys' heroes are probably the Mike Mignolas out there and guys like that really, you know, did come up with their own thing. And
hey, me too. I mean,
I
look at Firebreather, and sometimes I go, why am I... I tweeted about this the other day. But it's something that Jai Nitz and a couple other my friends and I talk about, which is we spend too much time chasing Batgirl, which means we spend too much time chasing work for hire at Marvel or DC. Because at the time, at a certain point in Jai's life, he was really hustling after the Batgirl book.
Interesting.
And he was doing it to the detriment of his own creation, you know. And we're like, you know what, let's not chase Batgirl. Let's do our thing and do it well. And if the majors notice you and they come get you, fine. But do your thing and do it well. And it brings me back to my character Firebreather, who, you know, Toon and I, for a long time, pitched Marvel on a lot of different ideas and got really close with a lot of ideas. And then finally we got discouraged and said, let's just do Firebreather and Image on our own. Let's just do our thing. And in the end, we've made more on Firebreather, optioning it to Paramount, optioning it to Cartoon Network, in production now at Cartoon Network.
Fantastic.
Than we would have ever made on page rates on that book. You know, and we own it. So, we were joking in Seattle, but I think I said to Jeff Johns, the two ways to make it in this business are to own something or create a Batman that winds up in a movie. Those are the two long-term routes to success. You know? And for me, I'm all about owning things. I mean, you know, we optioned the coffin. I'm on the verge of optioning another thing that I can't talk about.
Cool.
But, you know, it's what's cool about that is it's another way for you to make it in this business with a dwindling sale.
Absolutely. Well, and then, you know, you look at the Men of Action studio and, you know, Casey Kelly and Steve Siegel and
Duncan Rowe.
Exactly. And creating Ben 10 and counting the money. And that's great. Yeah. And really creating something that kids really love, genuinely love.
Oh, and that's our hope for Firebreather. Right now it's a 2-hour TV movie.
Fantastic.
Which is a backdoor pilot for a series, which we hope happens.
Okay. Because live action?
It will be like Clone Wars. It will be CGI animation.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great, man. Very cool. So, like, where are you guys in production?
I think the voice work is all done.
Oh, damn you. I would have, you know, demanded a part. Come on.
I can't tell you who's in this because Cartoon Network will hang me.
Okay.
But I don't think we could hire you. There's some names on this project, man.
All right, I'll do what I can with Adult Swim. That's fine.
When they told me who they got, I was like, I had to pick my jaw off the table.
Wow.
Really exciting people.
Fantastic.
And then Peter Chung is our director from Eon Flux.
Yes, that's great.
Super talented people working on this thing, and we're excited about it, and we hope it's well received, and that we get a series, and then we get toy money like the Ben 10 guy.
Wow, that's great, man. Well, good for you and Andy. That's fantastic. You guys, you know, you and Coon, two good guys and everything, and
we hope it happens. And you know what? If it doesn't happen, if it's just a TV movie, guess what? That's awesome.
Hell yeah.
You know, that's beautiful. I'll take that.
Very cool, man. That's great. Oh, this is good, Phil. Wow, and now, you know, we had a nice Leo Biscaglia ending there. Very, very uplifting.
Uplifting, you know.
We'd hug if we could.
No,
that'd be too messy.
Too
nobody would want to see that.
I mean, when you get two comics pros in a room, it turns into a big grouse fest. And I don't want to leave anyone with the opinion that I'm world-weary. I'm having a blast at this game. And, you know, every second I get to not have a day job, I won.
I hear you.
I love it.
Absolutely, man. No, you're kicking ass.
Yeah.
No, I'm really happy, Phil. I think you're working with publishers that believe in you, and I think that's terrific, and you're writing great stories. So keep it up. And issues of The Anchor, Green Hornet.
And Gen 13. We didn't even talk about Gen 13.
What's
that? Another show.
I didn't even know. My man, we'll save it for C2E2. I didn't know you were coming to Gen 13.
Yeah, they're not out yet, but I'm on Gen 13 now.
When does that start?
35, I think, is my first issue. So,
who's your artist?
The great young Crudy Torian, who's a sort of a J. Scott Campbell disciple.
Oh, very cool.
He'll be bringing people back to those visual, at least, the glory days of Gen 13.
Is this a reboot, or is this where they are today?
We're picking up right from the World's End stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I guess we can talk about it at C2E2. I don't want.
Yeah, we'll talk. Yeah, let's talk about it
forever.
No worries. No, we did good though. This is great, and I'm very happy with all the good news you got going on. And yeah, I don't think anyone is taking a pessimistic view of what's going on with you. Things are good for Phil Hester. This is a good thing.
Things are good for comics too, actually.
Absolutely.
I'm excited about where we are.
That's cool, man. Well, look forward to seeing you at C2E2, and thanks for the time tonight. And we will talk down the line when there are new things to talk about in the Project Superpowers world, the darkness, and other future things for Top Cow and the like, and the anchor, of course.
Great. I can't thank you enough, John.
That's Phil Hester. Look for him at C2E2, the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo, and that's coming up in just a couple weeks now, April 16th through the 18th, downtown Chicago at McCormick Place. Word Balloon will be there as well on the floor, getting a lot of interviews. Please say hi if you see me. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Sutris reminding you, you can find Word Balloon all over the internet. Of course, we're at wordballoon.com. Look for our archive of well over 300 interviews with comic book artists, writers, filmmakers, actors, directors. You name it, they're there waiting for you at wordballoon.com. Follow me at Twitter under John Word Balloon or under John Sutris at Facebook. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can reach me through the Word Balloon message boards. Just click on the link at wordballoon.com, start a thread over there, or chime in on some of the threads that are already up there. Send me an email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.